He threw Crassus a quick salute and swung down from the restless beast.
"I ordered the call to arms," he said shortly. "We don't have much time."
"For what, Max?" Crassus demanded.
"You were right. It was too easy," Max said. "The Carnim are coming. At least two separate elements, coming from the northeast and southeast, and they're converging here."
"Crows!" Crassus spat. "How many?"
"So far, better than 30,000," Max said.
Crassus just stared at him, his face going pale.
"How? How could they have that many in the field?"
"Sir," Marcus growled, "it doesn't matter how. They're here."
Crassus clenched his hands into fists and then nodded sharply at the first spear.
"Assemble and prepare to move down the hill to support the defense of the palisade wall," he said sharply.
"Knights to stay at the crown of the hill in reserve. Maximus, how many of your troops are in?"
"Not many," Max said. "Most are still standing picket."
"Then you're taking over as Knight Tribune," Crassus said. "Get moving."
Max saluted and strode off.
"Marcus," Crassus said. The first spear banged out a crisp salute.
"Let's get to work, sir."
Chapter 42. Isana watched as the Slive approached the docks at Fell Cove, a small port town on Alera's western coast, many miles south of Founderport and the Ellenarch. The place had a seedy look to it, the boards of its houses weathered with age and smeared with tar. From the looks of the docks, one could practically step off of one's ship and directly into the town's drinking house or its brothel, possibly both. Aaron stood beside her, smiling.
"Don't look so alarmed, my lady," he murmured. "We won't be staying long enough for it to make you uncomfortable."
Isana glanced down at Aaron and smiled.
"Does it show?"
"From about a league away," Aaron replied. "Truth be told, I don't care much for the place either."
"Then how did we settle upon it as our landing point?" Isana asked.
"It's close to Mastings," Aaron said. "The legions are probably there already, and even if they aren't, Nasorg almost certainly is."
"Shouldn't we have sailed directly to Mastings, then?"
Deimos's voice cut into the conversation as the captain came striding down the deck.
"The Carnim have been rather narrow-minded about commandeering every ship that they can get their hands on. I'd rather keep mine."
"Which makes Fell Cove our only real option," Aaron said. "The Carnim don't keep a presence here. Something about the smell." Isana arched an eyebrow.
"Surely they don't leave it entirely unguarded."
"No," Aaron said. "They pay a local, businessman named Ibrus to commandeer ships and keep them informed about any naval movements."
"What's to stop him from taking the Slive?" Isana asked Deimos.
"He's greedy," Deimos said. "Not suicidal."
"I've done business with him before," Aaron added. "He's as reasonable as any of his ilk can be." The ship's lines got tossed out to the dock rats, and the men drew the Slive up to the dock and made it fast. Isana noted that a broad-bladed axe had been set out beside the base of each mooring line on the ship, presumably so that they could be severed quickly if necessary. The ship's hull bumped against the dock, and Deimos nodded to Aaron, holding out his hand.
"There you go."
Aaron slapped a jingling leather pouch into Deimos's palm and nodded to him.
"Pleasure doing business." "I always enjoy working with cursors," Deimos replied. "They pay on time, and almost never try to kill me afterward."
Tavi emerged from the passenger cabin wearing a mail shirt and his weaponry. Araris, similarly clad, also appeared. Tavi nodded and smiled at Isana before walking over to the hold and growling something in the Carnish tongue. An answering snarl rose from the depths of the ship, and then Varg came up the stairs through the cargo doors. The enormous Carne wrinkled his nose and growled something, to which Tavi responded with a bark of laughter. Varg disdained the gangplank. He simply put one hand on the ship's railing and vaulted lightly down to the dock beneath. Lightly being a relative term, Isana supposed. The dock rats all paused in their tasks for a moment, staring at Varg. The big carne stretched, then deliberately yawned, displaying a mouthful of fangs. The dock rats went hurriedly back to their tasks. As Tavi passed Isana on the way to the gangplank, she asked him, "What did he say?" "That he's glad to get off this ship," Tavi said. "He says it smells like wet people here." Isana blinked. I didn't realize." She glanced at the carne. "Was he making a joke?" "I'm not really sure," Tavi said. He gave Varg a wry glance. "I don't think I'm supposed to be. Excuse me." He paced down the gangplank to stand near the carne. Kitai climbed down from the ship's rigging and dropped the last several feet to the deck. Over the course of the journey, her hair had begun to grow in again, and was now a short, fine brush of white offset by her longer mane. She gave a brilliant smile to one of the crewmen, a brawny young sailor with a fresh cut running across his chin. The man visibly flinched and seemed to remember urgent duties requiring his attention elsewhere on the ship. Kitai murmured to Isana, "I take my shirt off once, and it is as if these Alarans think I have invited them all to mate with me." Isana glanced at the retreating young sailor. "Oh, dear. Why didn't you say anything?" Kitai shrugged. "There was nothing to it. He made advances. I objected." Isana arched an eyebrow. "I see. At what point did your objections draw blood?" "Here," Kitai said, drawing a finger across her chin. "And another you can't see, right about—" She started untucking her shirt from her trousers. Isana sighed and put her hands over Kitai's. "Later, dear. For the time being, let's just get off the ship." She turned to Kitai and offered her one of the traveling cloaks she had folded over her arm. Kitai took the cloak, evidently well pleased with herself, and threw it about her shoulders, covering her distinctive hair with the hood. "Though I hardly see the point of wearing any kind of disguise," she said. "Not with the carne with us." Isana donned her own cloak. "Humor me." "Easy enough," Kitai said agreeably. Araris, now cloaked and hooded, came up to Isana, a satchel over his shoulder. He offered it to her and she took it, her fingers brushing his. His eyes shone for a moment, and he bowed his head to her. "Ready?" Isana felt a sudden flutter of amusement mixed with realization from Kitai, who murmured tartly, "Why, I expect she is." "Kitai!" Isana whispered fiercely, her face heating. "All that fuss about the men in a separate room. I should have shared a room with my Alaran and you with yours. We all would have been happier." "Kitai!" "Though I suppose we might not have gotten things done quite as quickly," Kitai said. She tilted her head and gave Araris a frank appraisal. "How is he with his mouth?" Araris looked considerably more shaken than he had when he'd received his hideous belly wound.
"Ladies," he said, "excuse me."
He hurried down the gangplank to move to Tavi's side. Kitai laughed, a merry, silvery sound. "Alarans make this easy."
"You're shameless," Isana protested, but she felt her mouth turning up into a smile.
"Of course," Kitai said. "It's obviously a side effect of being an unlettered savage."
She pursed her lips thoughtfully and glanced at Tavi, who was speaking intently to Aaron.
"My Alaran does not know."
"Correct," Isana said.
"You would prefer that he did not know?"
"Yes."
Kitai smiled faintly.
"There were times when Dorogo would meet with a woman after my mother died. I was much younger. I thought he was betraying her memory. It was painful."
Isana shivered a little at the sudden sense of hollow loss and loneliness she felt in Kitai. The loss of her mother must have affected her deeply, still to bring up such intense emotion years and years later.
"I know better now. My mother was dead. Dorogo should not be expected to spend the rest of his life alone. But it was a difficult thought to hold between my ears.
"I'll tell him," Isana said, "when he doesn't already have so much on his mind."
Kitai nodded. "Then I will not bring it up. I will not lie to him, should he ask me. But I will not draw his attention to it.
Thank you, Kitai."
She inclined her head and said, "But tell him soon. The next time we stay at an inn, matters can be better arranged."
They descended from the ship to join the others, and together walked through Fell Cove to see this man Aaron had mentioned, Ibrus. It had been sundown when they made port, and it was well on toward full darkness now. Fell Cove had very few fury lamps on its streets. In fact, the town itself seemed to have none at all. The only lamps in evidence were outside of homes and businesses, doubtlessly personal property. The streets were crude mud tracks, utterly lacking the properly fury-crafted stone, or even the ruder, more common cobblestones. Fell Cove's filth ran through garbage-choked gutters on either side of the street, and the whole place smelled awful. Indeed, as they proceeded into the town, Varg seemed to shrink a few inches, his shoulders hunching up even higher, his head lower and often turned aside, as if to seek some respite from the stench. There was only one street, and it wound back and forth from the ocean up the steep side of a hill. Aaron led them to its very last winding, and to an enormous house that may at one time have looked respectable, perhaps as a residence for a magistrate or a minor count. Now its white stone had been stained by years of weather and sun, and most of the windows were out. What had once been a small garden in front of the house had become a patch of weeds and brambles so thick that it had strangled itself to death. Aaron walked up to the front door of the house, drew his knife, and banged the pommel of his dagger several times upon the door. The door was cheap and weather-worn, clearly a relatively recent addition to the house, and it was marked with the shallow round indentations of what Isana assumed had to be thousands of other people banging on it with a dagger's pommel. For a long while nothing happened.
"Should we let ourselves in?" Tavi asked.
"Oh, crows no," Aaron said quickly. "Bad idea."
He pounded on the door again.
"Ibrus," he shouted, "I need to talk to you, and I've got cash."
Footsteps thudded on floorboards inside the house and grew louder. Shortly the door was opened by an enormous man in a food-stained shirt. He had a heavy brow, a thick neck, and something had removed an entire section of his upper lip, leaving his teeth bared in a perpetual snarl.
"Siggy," Aaron said, smiling. "Is Ibrus in?"
The big man's voice was slurred by his mangled face, but its tone was surprisingly warm and mellow.
"It's late, Appius. He's told you about his hours before."
"I'm prepared to make it worth his time."
"Heard that one before," Siggy said.
Aaron tossed a pair of coins at the big man, and Isana saw the glitter of gold in the light of the single fury lamp outside the front door.
"I'm prepared to make it worth his time," Aaron said in exactly the same voice as before.
"Come in," Siggy said.
He pocketed the coins and led them into the entry hall, a large room obviously used as a reception area, centered around a large, and largely defunct, fountain with its own pool. The water was dark and stagnant. Siggy paused for a moment as Varg crouched to come through the door and stared at the Kane.
"Wait here. I'll go get him."
"Charming," Tavi murmured to Aaron after Siggy had gone.
"It helps to speak the language," Aaron said.
"Appius?" Tavi asked. "Everybody in this part of the realm has at least two or three aliases. If you don't pick up a couple, you'll never fit in."
"This Ibrus," Tavi asked. "Can we trust him?"
"Absolutely," Aaron replied. "To do whatever benefits Ibrus most."
Tavi nodded, looking around the shadowy hall.
"I don't like it.
If there was any other way to secure mounts..."
"There isn't," Aaron said firmly.
Tavi growled beneath his breath, looking around them.
"Still..."
More footsteps sounded, and another light approached. Siggy bore a fury lamp in one hand and a heavy cudgel in the other. A man walked beside him. He was a little taller than average and well-built, his thick red hair and beard shot with grey. He wore a fine robe, much like those sported by senators and the most pretentious of the citizenry, though it was rumpled and stained with what Isana hoped was wine.
"Appius," Ibrus said. He yawned. "I was just finishing a rather fine evening's entertainment, and I cannot adequately express how annoying your presence is."
Isana found herself focusing more intently on Ibrus. Though the man looked and sounded both bored and mildly angry, his true emotions were considerably different. He was tense. Afraid.
"You're a middleman, Ibrus," Aaron replied. "Everyone wants to see you in the middle of the night, or in the middle of a bonfire. There's not much in between."
"Some day your mouth is going to get you into trouble, Appius," Ibrus said darkly.
Aaron lifted a purse and jingled it.
"I'd better move it to where it won't disturb you, then. I need horses."
Ibrus scowled, then rolled his eyes.
"Siggy!"
The big man held out his hand, and Aaron tossed him the purse. Siggy dumped the coins out in his palm, looked at them, and then dumped them back into the purse, which he handed to Ibrus with a nod.
"There's not going to be much to choose from," Ibrus warned him. "The free Alarans were grabbing anything they could get their hands on."
"What have you got?" Aaron asked.
The two men got down to haggling over horses. As they did, Isana became increasingly aware of the discrepancy between Ibrus's manner and his actual state of mind. There was nothing unusual, really. Most people could dissemble reasonably well in that sense. After all, it was part of being polite and showing common courtesy to others. But ever since her venture into the Leviathan-haunted sea, her watercrafting senses had become increasingly fine, able to distinguish details and nuance with greater and greater clarity. Ibrus's emotions were not simply a repressed reaction he preferred not to display. He was actively worried, impatient, and increasingly frightened. "You're expecting someone," Isana said sharply. The conversation stopped, and every pair of eyes in the room turned to her. She hadn't meant to say it aloud, but the die was cast. She stepped forward, locking her gaze to Ibrus's, and spoke clearly. "Who are you expecting, Ibrus? Why does a simple horse trade frighten you so?"
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Ibrus replied.
Tavi's eyes narrowed. He traded a quick glance with Isana and said,
"You're sweating, Ibrus, even though it's a lovely cool evening."
Araris, who had become motionless once Isana began speaking, abruptly moved. His sword cleared its sheath as he spun, and the blade struck through what looked like empty air. A spray of blue sparks and a ribbon of blood spilled forth from nowhere, splattering the floor and Ibrus's fancy robes. There was a cry of pain, and a man appeared, tall, slender, dressed in mail, and bearing a sword. Araris's blade had sheared through his armor like a knife through cheese, and a long gaping wound in the metal links was matched by the far more gruesome wound in the flesh beneath. The man went down, screaming, dropping his sword to clutch at the innards spilling from his belly. Isana recognized the man. He had been one of Senator Arnus's singulares.
Which meant...
There was an enormous roar of shattering stone, and the wall nearest the party suddenly fell inward toward them, shattering along the way. Isana saw Araris leap back, directly into Tavi, pushing him away from the falling stone. Araris went down underneath the fall of white marble and screamed. Isana found herself falling backward and realized that Kitai had seized her by the back of her dress and hauled her away from the deadly rain of marble. Aaron flung himself into a neat forward roll toward Ibrus, and when he came to his feet again, the young cursor sank one of his knives to the hilt in Ibrus's throat. Siggy whirled toward him and leapt on Aaron, flattening the smaller man to the floor. He seized Aaron's throat between two huge hands, and Isana saw the young man's face turn purple. She rolled and came to her knees, then gestured at the fountain of stagnant water and called to Ryl. A jet of water leapt from the pool and flashed across the room. It slammed into Siggy's maimed face and simply clung to his head, filling his eyes, nose, mouth, and ears. The big man released Aaron's throat in a panic, reaching up to claw uselessly at the water covering his face. Aaron arched his body and threw Siggy off him. Before the big man could fully settle to the floor, Aaron had produced another knife and flicked its razor-sharp blade across Siggy's throat. The man's terror flooded over Isana, layer after layer of it, like a landslide of some kind of hideous stinking mud. It weighed her down relentlessly, magnified by her contact with the dying man, but she kept the tendril of water on his face until his movements went frantic, then suddenly slackened, his fear abruptly vanishing. Isana released the crafting with a sob and began to struggle to her feet, calling for Tavi. Just as she did, someone smashed the fury lamp, which rose up into a brief column of fire and vanished, leaving the ruined house in utter darkness. Sparks leapt up across the room for a moment as blade met blade, showing Isana a flash image. Araris, his lower legs pinned beneath the rubble of the fallen wall, and another large, muscular man, also one of the senator's bodyguards, standing over him with a great warhammer raised over his head. Isana cried out. In the renewed darkness, she could not see her target, so she did the only thing she could think of. With Rill's help, she seized the entire contents of the stagnant pool and flung them in a single coherent mass toward the man about to kill Araris. There was an enormous slap, splashing sound and a cry of surprise. Another flash of sparks showed her the man lying dazed on the ground several feet away and a drenched Araris choking and coughing. Then someone with an iron grip seized her by the hair. They jerked back on her head, snapping it back to a painful angle, and then a line of fine, deadly cold settled across her throat. Isana froze in place. Her captor and she sat motionless in the dark for a time, until finally a cold female voice said, "Get the light back on and report." Someone produced a pair of small fury lamps and set them on the floor nearby, and Isana could see what was left. Araris lay on the floor, still trapped from the knees down. His hands were empty and spread, and a man stood over him with the tip of a long blade resting in the hollow of Araris's throat. The man with the huge hammer looked up from lighting the fury lamps.
"Aresius is dead," he said, his tone neutral. "So are both locals. We've taken two prisoners."
The woman holding Isana said, "Scipio? The Carne?" The man with the warhammer swallowed.
"Gone."
Her captor suddenly pulled hard on Isana's hair, flinging her onto her back on the ground. The tip of a sword came to rest upon her cheekbone, and Isana found herself facing Phrygia Navaris. Navaris looked the worse for wear. The skin of her face was peeling badly, and looked as if it had been blistered. Her short hair was burned to a lighter color, similarly, and her hands and arms told the same tale of too much sun and the exquisitely painful consequences.
"Steadholder," Navaris murmured, "give me one reason why I shouldn't kill both of you. Right here. Right now."
Chapter 43. Tavi had been unable to sense anything of Ibris's emotions as the man spoke with Aaron. That was hardly unusual. His own watercrafting senses were still somewhat clumsy, certainly in comparison to those of a real watercrafter like his mother. But all the same, something about their situation had made him uneasy, and when his mother had confronted Ibris, he was more than willing to back her. Then Araris had moved, his sword screaming from its sheath and drawing blood from a man who had kept a wind-crafted veil wrapped around himself, even as he slipped up closer to their group, specifically toward Tavi. Tavi drew his sword, but even as he did he felt a surge of power shiver through the ground beneath him, and then the head of an all-metal war maul smashed through the nearest wall as if it had been made of beeswax. The whole wall came down, all at once, under a wave of earth-crafted power, spreading out from the opening created by the blow of the hammer. Tavi hardly registered what was happening before Arara slammed into his chest, sending him reeling back from the falling stone. The Singulare cried out as hundreds of pounds of rock fell on him. Tavi got to his feet just as Aaron sprinted by him. He felt a thrum of tension in the air behind him and turned just in time to meet a descending blade with his own. Steel rang on steel, and Tavi found himself facing Phrygia Navaris. The woman's face was peeling, the skin red, and healing from what must have been blisters, but her eyes were still just as cold, and her sword moved in a shining blur as she instantly recovered from the parried blow and sent another attack snaking toward him. Tavi had no time to think about defenses or lessons. Pure instinct guided his arm as he blocked a deadly combination, barely sliding out of the last attack, a cut that turned into a thrust that came slithering toward his belly. Seemingly of its own accord, his hand lashed out as Navaris leaned into the thrust, and his fist struck her in the mouth. She whipped her head aside at the last second, and the blow landed with little force, but her eyes burned with a sudden cold fury. Tavi found himself forced back on his heels as blow after blow rained down on him. What counterattacks he could manage were weak, and Navaris slapped them aside almost contemptuously. Tavi's heart pounded in terror. He barely caught blow after blow, turning them aside by the barest of margins. Twice Navaris's sword actually struck his mail shirt, severing rings and sending them bouncing to the ground with sharp tinkling sounds, and if he escaped with his flesh unbroken, it seemed little more than a stroke of inordinate fortune. Navaris howled and her blade blurred even faster. Tavi suddenly became aware that he had fallen out of the smooth rhythm that he had instinctively grasped and used to defend himself, that Navaris's sword had begun to move more evasively, that he was losing track of its motion. At last he was slow to recover from a particularly strong parry, and Navaris's eyes blazed as she struck his blade aside, leaving him wide open as her sword descended for a killing stroke. "Aleran!" Kitai cried. He saw her sword tumble by, spinning, thrown with the inordinate strength of an earthcrafter. It missed Navaris by 3 feet and smashed into the room's sole fury lamp. The room plunged into darkness. Tavi dropped straight down and felt Navaris's sword pass through the air where he'd just been standing. Navaris cursed and he felt her slow down, trying to locate him, to feel where his sword was. Struggling went on in the darkness. Someone was thrashing around. A man shouted and he heard the heavy thud of exchanged blows, flesh on flesh. Then Navaris hissed, and Tavi felt her sword coming at him, a disc of cold, deadly steel inscribed on his mind by the course of her blade. The force behind the blow was terrible, both physically and in the weight of Furycraft behind it, infusing the steel with all the strength of her mad will. Tavi would have to meet that strength with his own, or Navaris's sword would shatter Tavi's, and Tavi would find himself shattered shortly after. He spun, putting his strength and weight behind his blade, swinging in a stroke that would meet Navaris's squarely, furiously focused on his own sword. The blades met. Steel chimed on steel, a note that was high and pure and piercing. A blinding shower of sparks erupted from the meeting blades, and Tavi saw a frozen image of the room. Navaris, her teeth clenched in hate. Kitai bleeding from a split lip, struggling with an armored man for possession of a sword. Isana kneeling, her expression colder and more terrible than he would have believed possible, a hand extended toward a man who thrashed on the ground, his face completely covered by a blob of dirty water. Then the darkness returned, and Tavi moved a few steps to one side before freezing again. He clenched his teeth in frustration. The others needed his help, but he didn't dare move toward them. The sound would have told Navaris precisely where he stood, and if he didn't have every bit of his attention focused on her, he'd never be able to defeat her attack. Again Navaris's sword came at him, and again he met it with his own. In the flash of contact, he saw the other armored man flying back through the air, and Varg standing over Kitai, his arms extended. Aaron lay unmoving on the floor. Araris's body was arched up in effort or in pain as he struggled to free his legs from the rubble. Tavi took two steps back and froze again, mentally cursing, as he desperately sought Navarre's next attack. He was utterly unprepared when an enormous hand landed on his shoulder, and only the sudden rusty, musty scent of the carne's fur prevented him from turning and thrusting in sheer panic.
"Aleron," Varg growled. "It is over. Come with me." "Go," Tavi whispered.
Varg kept his poor hand on Tavi's shoulder, roughly directing him. Tavi had to put his trust in the carne's guidance. If he felt his way along with tentative steps, Navarre's could close the distance and kill him. But without someone to guide her own feet, she wouldn't dare rush after him blind. So Tavi broke into a run and trusted Varg to guide his steps. They emerged into the comparative brightness of the outdoors, and Kitai was coming hard behind them, weaponless, carrying Eren slung over one of her shoulders. Tavi took the lead, taking them around the corner of the house where they would be out of sight of the house's entrance.
"Eren," Tavi breathed.
Kitai put him down carefully, supporting his mostly limp weight. The little cursor sucked in his breath as if through a tiny reed, a strangled rattle accompanying it. There were bruises on his throat that were already darkening, and it was entirely possible his windpipe had been crushed. His eyes were glazed and unfocused, while his chest labored to bring in enough air.
"What do we do?" Kitai asked. "He needs a watercrafter," Tavi said.
Varg knelt down in front of Eren and peered at his throat. Then he growled,
"Give me a quill."
"What?" Tavi asked. Kitai slung her pack off and reached into it. She opened the pack and produced a writing quill. Varg took it, and with a quick motion of his claws, snipped the quill about 2 inches from its end. He held it up to the light and squinted at it. Then he reached down with a single claw and ripped open Eren's throat. Tavi cried out, reaching for Varg's wrist. The carne growled and said,
"There is no time for this."
Tavi stared at Varg for a moment, then leaned back on his heels and nodded once. Varg leaned down and thrust a claw into the open wound. Then, his motions delicate in one so large, he thrust the quill into the cut. Eren shuddered and drew in a sudden deep breath. It hissed through the hollow quill and then hissed again as he exhaled. His breathing slowed and steadied. He blinked his eyes several times, focusing slowly.
"It is dirty," Varg rumbled. "But there was no time to clean it before he would have died. Perhaps your sorceries can cleanse the wound later."
He took Eren's hand and lifted his fingers to the protruding end of the quill.
"Hold this in. If it comes out, you die."
Eren, pain in his expression, stared up at the carne and nodded.
"We must go back for them," Kitai whispered.
Tavi held up his hand and whispered back.
"We've only got one sword among us, and they have hostages. If we go in again, they'll use Araris and Asana against us, assuming they don't kill them out of hand."
Kitai bared her teeth in a silent snarl of frustration. Tavi chewed on his lip, thinking furiously. Then he nodded and looked at Varg. "Ibrus said he had horses. They must be close. Take these two and find them."
"You can't go back alone," Kitai hissed.
Tavi met her eyes and said, "We aren't going to be able to take them back by force. And whatever happens, we'll need the horses, who won't let Varg handle them. Eren can't do it either. So go. Now." Kitai scowled furiously at him, but then she rose and offered Eren a hand up. Varg lifted his head, sniffed the air for a few seconds, and started off at a shambling lope. Kitai, staying close to Eren, followed the carne. Tavi took off his belt, bent over at the waist, and wriggled out of his mail shirt, letting it fall to the ground. Though it would have provided him some protection in the event of a fight, it also would make noise when he moved. For the moment, stealth was at a premium. He buckled his sword belt on again and stalked through the darkness back to Ibris's house, creeping forward until he crouched beneath one of the broken windows outside of the entry hall. There were two small fury lamps inside, casting a dim red-orange glow.
"Steadholder," Navarre's murmured as Tavi approached. "Give me one reason why I shouldn't kill both of you. Right here. Right now."
Tavi's stomach got a sick, sinking feeling. He put his hand on his sword. If it came to that, he would attack them before he stood by and let them kill his mother and his friend.
"Did you hear me, Steadholder?" Navarez said. "This isn't a rhetorical question. If there is some reason I should leave you alive, you should tell me."
Tavi drew the blade perhaps 2 inches from its sheath.
"I suppose that depends," Isana responded.
Her voice was steady, confident. Tavi froze again.
"Upon what?" Navarez asked.
"How loyal you are to the Senator." Silence.
"I know who he serves," Isana continued. "Invidia Aquitaine is in fact my patron, too. I doubt she'll thank Arnas for interfering in my work. I shudder to think of her reaction should he actually eliminate me."
More silence.
"I spent nearly a year campaigning for the abolition of slavery for Lady Aquitaine and the Dianic League," Isana replied. "And the last 6 months I've been visiting members of the League, raising funds and supplies for the refugee camps. The wives of every count, lord, and high lord from here to Riva have met with me, given me money, and know I was coming to the Elenarch. Are you sure he's willing to be implicated in my death?"
"You're lying," the cutter said.
"Can you afford to assume that?" Isana's tone turned frank.
"Do you want to make that decision for him, Navarez?" Tavi felt his mouth stretch into a grin.
"And the Singulare?" Navarez asked. "Why should I spare him?"
"Scipio is his friend," Isana replied. "Dead, he's of no further use to you. Alive, he's a hostage."
"Dead, he's of no further threat to me either," Navarez murmured.
"I can't argue with that," Isana said. "I'd be afraid of him too, particularly if I was you." Navarez's voice turned very quiet.
"Particularly?"
"Yes." "It must be difficult for you in some ways. After all, you've won more duels than Araris Valerian ever fought. You've certainly killed many more armed foes than he ever did. Yet I should think that you've lived your whole life in his shadow. He has such a name, after all. No matter how many times you prove it, he'll still be the best in everyone's mind." She let that sink in for a moment before she said, "If you fight him and lose, well, that would prove it for certain." Tavi edged up enough to be able just barely to see in the window. Isana sat on the floor between two corpses, Ibrus and his enforcer, and in front of Navarez, as composed as if she was having tea in the capital. Araris was still pinned under the rubble, and one of Arnas's singulares was standing over him, a sword to his throat. Isana was focused intently on Navarez, and Tavi suddenly realized that it was because she was reading Navarez's reactions to her words, using her watercraft to judge exactly what to say to the cutter, to discern what would motivate her. "Of course," Isana added, leaning forward slightly, "if you kill him here, you'll never have the chance to beat him. You'll never be able to prove beyond all doubt that you're the greatest sword in Alera. Whereas if you return him to your master alive, he'll most likely order you to dispose of him in any case." Navarez stared down at Isana, frozen, her eyes remote.
"You're better than he is, Navarez," Isana said. "You pinned him against the hull of the Mactus like an insect, and if he hadn't run, it would be over. You know you'll beat him if you fight him. Why not give yourself a chance to wipe his name away and replace it with yours?"
Isana frowned slightly, and Tavi heard a note of sympathy enter her voice, a bit of sadness touch her eyes.
"What else do you have?"
Navarez's nostrils flared, and her right hand suddenly trembled, fluttering at the end of her wrist. Tension entered her lean frame, and her breathing sped up for several seconds. Then she seemed to slump in place. Her eyelids lowered, half closing.
"Turndus," she murmured. "Arminius, bind them. We'll bring them with us."
The huge man whose hammer had smashed the wall nodded and bent down over Araris, levering the singulare's hands behind his back and binding them with a heavy leather cord. The other swordsman shook his head. "We're not going after Scipio?"
"His name isn't Scipio," Navarus said quietly. "It's Tavi of Calderon."
She moved abruptly, striking Isana on the cheek with the back of one hand with stunning force, knocking Tavi's mother to the floor. Tavi's fist clenched on his sword, but he controlled the sudden surge of rage and remained still and hidden in the deep shadows cast by the little fury lamps.
"And we won't have to go after him," Navarus murmured quietly. "He'll be coming after us."
Chapter 44. The plan was working perfectly, and that made Amara nervous. An evening and morning practicing under Gaius's tutelage had drastically expanded Amara's ability to craft a veil. It was not so much a matter of learning something new as it was of being presented with techniques she was already familiar with in new ways. Gaius seemed to have an instinctive knack for picking out the strengths and weaknesses of her crafting, and showed her how to apply the stronger aspects of her personal talents in a new way. By the time the sun was high, Amara was holding a veil nearly 10 feet across, with only a little more effort than it took to fly.
"Excellent," Gaius said, smiling. "I believe Maestro Vercani must have been your wind-crafting instructor."
"Yes," Amara said, smiling. She had never imagined herself managing a veil so large with such comparative ease. "Yes, he was. He thought very little of my work, too, except for the flying."
"Small-minded old goat," Gaius murmured,
suppressing another cough.
"He was of the school of thought that held that any fury-crafting concept worth employing was already being employed, and therefore there was no need to teach multiple approaches to any given task, since the one that he knew was already good enough."
"I just never thought of thinking of light as a windstream," Amara said. "Only bending it, like for a far-seeing. I can concentrate on windstreams all day."
"Fury crafting is as much about imagination as concentration," Gaius murmured. "Bear that in mind when you try anything new in your crafting, Countess. Imagination. Different ways of visualizing your goal. It wouldn't startle me in the least to see you manage quite a respectable level of weather crafting, should you wish it."
Amara blinked at him. "Really?"
"Certainly."
Bernard murmured,
"A breeze to blow away some of these bugs might be nice."
He squinted through the grass at the patrolled area.
"I'm still not sure we shouldn't do this at night."
"Of course we should do it at night," Amara said. "And that's when they'll expect anyone to try to sneak through their pickets. They'll have more men on duty and they'll be more alert. Whereas if we move through during the day, the men will be less cautious and more likely to be distracted." Bernard frowned and nodded.
"But if one of them does notice us, they'll have awfully nice light for shooting."
"And we'll have nice light for running away, unless you prefer to flee through strange country in the dark." Her husband's mouth twisted sourly.
"I suppose there's no good way to do this, is there?"
"Precisely,"
Gaius murmured wearily. Bernard nodded.
"Then now is as good a time as any."
"All right,"
Amara breathed. Bernard took up Gaius's stretcher and nodded at Amara. Then he half-closed his eyes, and the ground beneath her feet quivered for a moment, a pulse of movement that she could barely detect. A moment later it repeated, at the pace of a sleeping man's heartbeat. Amara murmured to Cirrus and felt the light around them change subtly as she brought up the veil. Everything outside the veil blurred, colours twisting and overlapping, shapes softening to mere blobs of colour. It was one of the things that made a windcrafter's veil different from one crafted with wood furies. The woodcrafted veil hid and concealed as long as there were shadows and vegetable shapes to manipulate. The air veil needed no such condition, but it did limit the amount of light that could pass through it, making the world outside the veil look like something seen through poor glass or murky seawater. There, Amara said quietly. Bernard?
Ready, he said.
And they started toward the enemy positions, with Amara in the lead. It took them most of the afternoon to reach the edges of the swamp, where the ground began to rise. Amara almost wanted to hold her breath as they approached the first concealed position. They passed by it, close enough to smell the smoke from a campfire, and to smell the aroma of freshly baked bread. Amara's stomach practically leapt from beneath her belt, and even Gaius looked a little wistful. It wasn't for another several steps that Amara saw the dogs, great rangy beasts, outside the camp. They were sprawled in the sunshine, asleep, and likely to stay that way under the gentle, slow pulse of Bernard's earthcrafting. And then they were past the outpost, with their foe none the wiser. The second watchpost was much the same. They walked slowly, steadily, by the tree supporting the observation blinds, and no one seemed to detect them. They kept up the same slow, careful pace for several hundred more blessedly dry, firm, grounded yards, uphill all the way. It couldn't be that simple, could it? Amara had imagined dozens of ways for their efforts to go disastrously awry, but none of them had come to pass. Something had to go wrong. Something always went wrong. Yet nothing had, and it made her nervous. A fresh breeze hit them, clean air that smelled of pine, and Amara felt like singing. And then hunting horns began blowing behind them. She and Bernard whirled to look back at the swamps, and Bernard cursed.
One of their patrols must have swept by and found our trail. They'll be coming.
Amara felt obliquely reassured by the sudden dour turn of events. Certainly it meant that a great many madmen were shortly to be pelting after them, determined to wipe them out, but at least she was in a familiar element. Very well. Our options?
Limited, Gaius said,
and coughed some more.
I can't erase our trail and still carry the stretcher, Bernard said. We should run for the mountains. Dark's coming on. If we're still free by then, it should give us enough time to get Gaius close enough.
Amara nodded. Then we run. She turned and began jogging forward, up the hill, disdaining the wind-crafted veil. The enemy already knew they were here. The veil would just be a drain of energy that could better be used to keep moving. Bernard kept up with her, even bearing Gaius's stretcher, though he breathed heavily as they ran. The land rose steadily, the willows and fronds of the swamps dying away, replaced by fir and pine. The hunting horns kept sounding behind them, and Amara thought she could hear them coming steadily closer. Amara had never particularly loved running, but the weeks of travel had done somewhat to harden her for the pace, and a gentle effort to guide Cirrus ensured that she never ran short of breath. As a result, her muscles didn't begin burning until well into the first hour, and she kept the pace quick and steady. The ankle the Garim had injured twinged several times, and she took care to place her foot carefully. But evidently she'd had enough time to recover from the injury, and she was able to keep the pace she had set for them. Bernard lumbered along behind her, implacably moving ahead despite his burden, and though his breathing was labored, his steps never faltered. Amara found a smooth track leading up towards the mountains and followed it, her shadow lengthening on the hillside in front of her as the sun set behind them. She kept running for another half hour and felt her arms and legs beginning to shake with weariness. That was when they heard the hunting horns being blown ahead of them, as well as behind. Amara slowed up, looking over her shoulder at Bernard.
"Aye," Bernard panted. "Surprised it took them this long."
He came to a halt, breathing heavily, and Amara wished she could send Cirrus to ease his breathing as well. But without being able to sense the changing pressures the way she sensed her own breathing, she could inflict a number of forms of injury on him, ranging from the inconvenient to the excruciating. Bernard glanced around, frowning in thought, as he settled the stretcher on the ground, staring up the slope toward the mountains, golden in the setting sun.
"They're moving fast. Mounted. We've only got a few minutes."
He reached into the stretcher,
murmured, "Excuse me, sire," and drew out his bow.
"Mounted," Amara murmured. She went to check on Gaius as Bernard strung his bow. The First Lord was pale with pain. He gave Amara a faint smile and said,
"I hardly have the right to say it, but I think I've had enough running today."
"Just rest," Amara said. She dragged the stretcher as gently as she could to one side, under the shelter of some pine branches. Then she went to her husband.
"I need to know something."
"Yes," Bernard said. "I was serious when I said I'd never done that with any woman but you."
She slapped his shoulder lightly.
"Mind on business, Count Calderon. You can calm animals. Can you uncalm them too?"
He grimaced.
"Spook their horses. Hate to do it. Horses are big, strong animals. Get them scared enough, they can hurt themselves pretty bad."
"They're coming to kill us," Amara pointed out.
"The riders are. I doubt the horses have strong feelings one way or the other."
Amara stopped and stared at him for a moment, smiling faintly.
"You can strike down enemy knights, shoot furious high lords from the sky, make war on creatures out of nightmares, and fight Garim the size of ponies three at a time without flinching. But you don't want to frighten horses."
Bernard looked at something of a loss. He spread his hands and said,
"I like horses."
She leaned over and kissed him. Then she said, "I need you to do it." He winced but nodded.
"Can you tell how many are coming?" she asked.
He jerked his head in a nod and rested his fingertips lightly on the ground.
8, he reported after a moment. "There's another group several miles behind them, much larger."
"Then the first 8 are the men who were on duty. The others, perhaps, the men who had been sleeping."
"Yes, dear," Bernard sighed, a smile lurking at the corners of his mouth. "You were right."
Amara peered at the falling sun. "I want to hit them and take 2 of their horses. Mounted in the dark, we can get farther."
"And the horses will know their way back to their stables," Bernard said.
He glanced toward the First Lord's stretcher.
"He can't ride, and in the dark on this terrain, there's no way we can sling the stretcher between our mounts."
"We don't need to," Amara said. "Remember how you pulled me back at Second Calderon?"
Bernard grinned suddenly. Amara had been too weary for full flight, and the skies had been heavily patrolled by the enemy. To catch a group of men they'd been pursuing, he'd used his intimate knowledge of the valley's furies to travel on a ripple of moving earth, a feat that only someone with such knowledge could manage. Amara could never have kept the pace, and so she had crafted a cushion of air to lift her from the ground and had held on to a tether fastened to Bernard's belt.
"Might work," he said, "but it will be loud."
"Not as much as you'd think. I can suppress some of it."
"How long can you sustain it?" Bernard asked.
"As long as I need to."
Horns sounded again upslope and were answered distantly from behind them. This time Amara actually caught a flash of movement in the trees.
"All right," she said quietly. "This is what I want to do."
The first rider to come plunging down the trail never had a chance. Amara dropped her veil when he was 20 feet away, and by the time he saw Bernard standing with his great bow drawn tight, it was too late for him to avoid the shot. The Count of Calderon's arrow took him in the bridge of his nose and lifted him from the back of his horse as if struck with a lance. A flash of silver collar proclaimed the man one of the immortals. The second rider shouted and lifted his spear, but he could do no more before Amara settled a veil around him, blotting him from sight and half-blinding him. The man hesitated, slowing, and the horse of the rider immediately behind him crashed into him, screaming in sudden fear at the scent of hot blood. Horses and men went sprawling, and the equine screams abruptly rose in pitch and volume. Animals bucked and thrashed in pure panic under Bernard's earth-crafting, sending some of the immortals sprawling to the ground, while others clung to their inexplicably hysterical mounts and were carried in every direction. Bernard wasted no time.
A dismounted immortal rose, weapon in hand, his eyes gleaming with exultation as he turned toward his prey. Another arrow slammed into his head, felling him instantly. A third immortal raised a circular steel shield to protect his face as he charged. Bernard shot him through the thigh, breaking the bone that supported it, and the immortal went down in a sprawl. Before he could recover, Bernard put a second arrow through his neck in a fountain of gore. The man staggered to his feet despite the horrible wounds, took two wobbling steps forward, and then sank to the earth and was still. Amara did not dare close with the remaining immortal on the ground. She was not entirely unskilled at swordplay, but she was no match for one of Kalare's manufactured madmen, and doubted she could kill him without being slain or badly injured herself. So with a flick of her hand, she dropped the veil that was hampering him and sent Cirrus surging around the immortal's face and head to cut off his air. The man staggered forward, sword raised, and Amara kept her own weapon in hand, but she circled away from him nimbly, carefully keeping the distance between them open. The immortal's face turned pink, then red. His steps began to falter. His face went purple. At the last, his lips were blue, his chest heaving desperately. Amara could feel him through Cirrus, struggling vainly to draw breath. Then he simply dropped, eyes staring sightlessly, and struggled to breathe no more. Amara stared at him blankly for a moment. Then she retched onto the ground in front of her. She remained there, head bowed forward, hands resting on her knees, and tried to get herself under control. Bernard's hand touched her shoulder. She gasped. I learned how, but I've never... I thought he would black out, and I could let him go. But he just kept fighting. His fingers tightened on her arm, gentle. "Bloody crows," she whispered. "That's an ugly way to kill a man." Bernard withdrew his hand and offered her his water flask. "Love," he said quietly. "Time." The hunting horns behind them sounded again. Amara squeezed her eyes shut, nodded once, and straightened. She took the flask, washed the horrible taste out of her mouth, and then drank. As she did, Bernard moved slowly forward toward the two horses he'd excluded from his crafting, the two lead horses, who were presumably the fastest of the group. Bernard spoke gently, and once again Amara felt the slow, steady pulse of a soothing earth crafting. Within a minute he had the reins of both animals and led them to her. Amara mounted up, while Bernard drew Gaius's stretcher out of its concealment, then tied one end of a line to it, the other to the saddle of Amara's mount. Amara turned, focusing on the stretcher, murmuring wordlessly as she willed Cirrus to lift it from the ground. Within seconds a small whirlwind had gathered beneath Gaius's stretcher, lifting it perhaps 18 inches above the earth. This time Bernard took the lead, veiling them as they rode through the darkening wood. Amara followed, dragging the stretcher on its miniature cyclone behind them to wipe away whatever trail they left behind. It wouldn't prevent Kalaris's men from tracking them, but it would conceal their numbers and the pace they set, denying the enemy information that might help them make intelligent choices in the pursuit. It would also force them to slow down if they wanted to keep the trail, especially after night fell. Shadows began to fall as Bernard led the horses north, off the trail and into the thickening forest. He turned east, toward the mountains, in a gradual arc, and all the while the horns of the immortals sounded in the gloom around them. Evening turned to dusk, turned to twilight. Terrain that had been difficult in dim light became treacherous in the dark, and Bernard slowed them down, allowing the horses to pick their way forward. The night began to turn cold. The strain of all the travel, of the run, of her ongoing fury craft to support the stretcher began to tell on Amara, and she found herself shuddering with cold and exhaustion. She very badly wanted to sleep. She very badly wanted to fall off the horse and lie still. But she clung grimly to the saddle and stayed upright for what felt like a week, then a month, then a year. And then the horses emerged from the pines, and Bernard let out a grunt of satisfaction. Amara lifted her eyes. In the starlight she could see very little, despite the hours her eyes had been given to adjust. It was as if half the stars were simply blotted away, or, she realized, overcast with clouds. She wearily hoped that it wasn't about to start raining, too.